You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Glenn L. Carl had worked for the CIA for nearly two decades when he was sent to interrogate a man who was codenamed Captus, thought to be a high-level al-Qaeda terrorist who might know the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. After months of questioning, it became clear to Mr. Carl that Captus was not who the CIA believed he was and that they had, in fact, the wrong man. Mr. Carl retired from the CIA in 2007, but he decided to write about his time as an interrogator, knowing that the agency would redact his work significantly before it was published. In his book, The Interrogator and Education, Glenn Carl describes his moral struggles with how interrogations are conducted, the use of torture, and his experiences confronting the agency's bureaucracy about permitting the use of these techniques. It's published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Glenn L. Carl to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
So how did you come to work for the CIA? Don't most people just join it right out of college?
No, I think most don't, actually. I think the average age of an officer candidate, which is basically what we would be, is substantially higher than right out of college, probably 27, 28 is my guess. They like people who have some life experience, work experience, and probably a graduate degree.
Did your friends and family find your decision unlikely or surprising?
Well, I actually only told my parents. I didn't tell my and I regretted having done so almost immediately. And I didn't tell my brother. I only have one brother for almost 10 years. And then I regretted not having done so sooner.
But what that's about it. What were you telling them you were doing?
Oh, well, agency officers have any number of covers that they live under. Mine was the most classic of all. I was most of the time to the real world a diplomat doing one thing or another legitimately.
In Valerie Plame Wilson's memoir, Fair Game, and the film that was made from it, much is made of how much she has to lie to family and friends and how upset they are when they find out all these years that she's been working for the CIA.
Well, my mother was not so much upset or angry as highly educated as she was. This espionage was not her world. So her frames of reference were all of the stereotypical ones, and I had trouble disabusing her of some of the wilder tales. But no one in my family was hostile or angry, but almost nobody knew.
Mm. Well, the new CIA directors from the military, are most of the people there college educated or people who've been through the military?
Well, it depends. You know, the agency is a huge organization, so there are all different stripes and feathers and kinds of work that people do and qualifications called for. But certainly in the Directorate of Operations, where I spent my career, or in the Directorate of Intelligence, where I worked at the end of my career, basically, the education level is very, very high.
Are there distinct groups or cliques within this huge organization?
Oh, of course, of course. The stereotype is that an exciting day for an analyst in the Directorate of Intelligence is that he has looked up from his shoes once or twice. And the epithet for a stereotypical case officer, someone in the field conducting espionage, as I was, is that we are knuckle draggers and crude.
And what was your official title?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer. I had different titles and different functions. I was an operations officer or a case officer. Both of those are what I did in my job. That job is to spot, assess, develop, recruit, and handle spies.
In the military, if you really want to get promoted, you have to have spend some time in a war zone. How do you get promoted in the CIA?
Well, in my particular branch of the agency, it all comes down to recruitments. The job is, as George Tenet said, to recruit spies and steal secrets. So you are judged by how many recruitments you make and how good they are. But that's large. And they're good by how sensitive is the information that they can provide.
Where were you recruiting people? I mean, this is past the Cold War, isn't it? So,
well, before I started
in the mid-80s. So you went to the Soviet Union first?
No. Well, you serve overseas and you live overseas in a standard assignment, as I had. Valerie Plame traveled around from her base in Washington. Some officers do that. My job was to be posted in a foreign country, live there for several years and conduct my work there.
You're the person, they say, works as part of the diplomatic corps, but everybody knows is really the CIA agent.
The first part of the sentence is right. Everyone guesses that playing spot the spook is one of the main pastimes in the diplomatic community, and sometimes people get it right, and often they get it wrong.
So this means you and your family had to move every time.
It's one of the benefits and burdens of the career. You move every 2 to 4 years, so it's enriching, but it's terrible on a spouse's career.
And how much does your wife know about all of what you're doing?
Well, in my case and today, with colleagues, they will know where I work and generally what I do. And because we share our lives, they'll know people who are of interest to me professionally. Beyond that, an officer wouldn't tell his or her spouse specifics of the operations.
Can you explain what it means to be surged?
Oh, yes. Yes.
This is different than what we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan.
No, there would be surges for each of those. A surge is just a general term for a increasing resources on a temporary and urgent basis to meet a problem someplace in the world.
So you would be based in Berlin, let's say, but suddenly surge to another place?
Quite possible, yes. Yeah.
Did your job description involve interrogations?
When I was being recruited and hired?
Or for much of the time you were at the CIA.
Oh, no, not at all.
We're talking here about an interrogation you got involved in.
No, not at all. The CIA as an institution wasn't in the business of interrogating anybody, and case officers are not, and certainly I was not. There was an interrogation component, actually, and in some ways fortunately for me, in my training, but that was to prepare us how to cope with being captured and interrogated, not how to interrogate someone else.
So who did interrogating before the CIA started getting involved in this after 9/11?
Well, the military has interrogators.
And then the FBI does
it. And the FBI does it as part of their profession. That actually is part of their job more, law enforcement officials. The agency didn't have to my knowledge, had no cadre, no office, no one who did this. It wasn't something we did.
Were you surprised that you were asked to help in an interrogation? I mean, they said, Glenn, we want you to go to this place and be involved in this interrogation of this person we consider to be somebody who we might get a lot of good information from.
Well, I guess I was surprised because it came out of the blue, I wasn't surprised that there be some task related to counterterrorism activity, but interrogating, I hadn't been thinking of doing that, certainly, no.
Although some of the skills you developed in recruiting people might be applied.
Well, this is what I found, actually, is that one imagines perhaps that there's some arcane art and skills and techniques to being an interrogator that are intrinsic to themselves, and I think that's wrong. To be an interrogator, I found, a good one, requires exactly the skills and attributes of being an operations officer, which is understanding human psyche.
Were you reluctant to go, or did you see this as an opportunity to expand your horizons?
Well, I wasn't reluctant to go at all. I was honored that I had been tasked or requested to become involved in what I was briefed was one of the most important cases in the war on terror.
My guest is Glenn L. Carl, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years, retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's written a book called The Interrogation and Education, published by Nation Books. How had the man you call Captus been captured?
Well, a huge amount of effort and work went into learning about this man for a long period of time. And the assessment was that he was a senior member of Al-Qaeda and critical in the functioning of the organization. So there was an operation designed because he was beyond the reach of the law, the decision was taken that he would be rendered is the term, which in this instance essentially meant kidnapped off of a street. And that operation was set up, and that's how he was brought under our control.
A street where?
In the Middle East, but I can't say where.
Is Captus a name that you've invented?
Yeah, it is. I couldn't use either the code name that we would use for him in our traffic or his true name.
Now, why would the CIA even object to using his real name? This is a matter of historic record, as is the fact that he was picked up in a street in Baghdad or Beirut or wherever.
Well, I think the view is that by the agency and the intelligence community that the rendition, detention, and interrogation program is extremely sensitive, is ongoing, and there's a fear of revealing sources and methods. So they essentially blocked out everything for a while.
In fact, a number of sections in the book are just have black bars over the lines of text. You left them in. Would it have been an alternative approach to just simply have published it with something in parentheses saying,
yes,
text omitted here?
Well, I thought about that a long time. Of the initial 100,000-word manuscript, the agency redacted or censored about 40,000 words. And I went through...
That's a lot.
That's quite a bit. I went through about 2 years of back and forth, which was increasingly frustrating. So in the end, the blacked out parts that remain, I decided to leave to show what I had struggled with, even though they really are only a small portion of what was taken out.
But it is interesting, in previous conversations, people have told me that some of the things that were taken out, they understood. And then others, they just could not figure out the logic behind them. Does that apply here as well?
Absolutely, it does. Sources and methods are a legitimate mandate for the agency to protect. I fully subscribe to that. That's a fair, necessary task to perform. But many of the redactions were silly individually and cumulatively irritating. At one point, I write about a U.S. government-issued urinal. And there's a reason, if you read the book, it actually makes perfect sense why it's there. But the agency took that out for a year and a half, and I argued for a year and a half that
for a urinal.
National security was not endangered by my having discussed a U.S. government urinal.
So this had to have been a very frustrating experience. At a certain point, it probably felt like, well, if I allow them to get away with all these redactions, there's no story to tell.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. The initial redactions were chapters long, entire, and the book was completely eviscerated. And I felt quite strongly that the objective was to dishearten me and make it impossible to write a book about this.
Well, this is not the first time the CIA or other government agencies have gone through this process. Is it always just a matter of trying to discourage you and anybody who might consider doing this in the future from publishing?
No, there are two reasons why that isn't the case. One, the specific subject matter of this book is particularly sensitive. Rendition, detention, interrogation, and torture are delicate topics for anyone, particularly for Americans who don't torture, we believe. And then, two, the political atmosphere changes over the years, and it depends on the environment and the administration, and that affects how responsive or tight the agency will be in its interactions with authors.
So we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the interrogation. My guest is Glenn L. Carl. His book, The Interrogation, an education published by Nation Books. Stay with us. We're back with Glenn L. Carl, a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years. When he retired in March 2007, he was Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. And he tells a story of an interrogation that he engaged in called The Interrogator, an education published by Nation Books. Who are you working with on this interrogation of CAPTUS?
Well, it was the United States, the CIA, that rendered him, that took him off the street.
And what made them think that he was a high-ranking member of Al-Qaeda?
It's a little hard for me to answer because I can't give the details about what who he was and what we knew. But I can say the agency spent years and thousands of man hours by people whom I know to be knowledgeable and people of integrity assessing and following what this man did.
What did he do?
The agency wouldn't let me say, I'm afraid. He was viewed, I think people will work out who he was, but I am not allowed to say.
But he was in finance?
He was viewed as one of the top half dozen or so people in al-Qaeda. And if we were able to disrupt his activities, we could probably cripple the organization and might well be able to find bin Laden.
And when somebody like Captus is captured, is there any time frame? Do they say, well, we'll get the information from him in such and such a amount of time, and then we'll either imprison him or free him?
Well, no, this is one of the dilemmas that everyone faced, and I did with Captus and the agency did in this, what came to be called the war on terror. We would pick people up either intentionally, as was the case with Captus, or in the aftermath of combat, and then have to decide what to do with these people. And the issue was, well, can you charge them? It's very difficult to charge people who are captured because of intelligence information. The standard of evidence and proof in a court is much different than in an intelligence assessment. And also, talking about sources in a court could undo all sorts of operations and techniques. So that's one complication. Another is that the agency and the government didn't want to let these people back on the street until we had learned everything we wanted to learn and accomplished the mission. The mission was fuzzy because it was to end terrorism. So these people sometimes, as was the case with Captus, entered a limbo where they could be held forever.
And what were they looking for? Information about how al-Qaeda worked, or were they looking for Osama bin Laden? Did they think he knew where Osama bin Laden was?
Well, both things are true. I mean, you go through Manning table questions are standard things. Who works for whom? With whom do you speak? Where do you go? How do you do it? What parts of the world? What are their names? What ways do you communicate? All of this is quite standard. And then the specific functions professionally that Captus had were of great interest. And each of those could lead back up in the organization to bin Laden, possibly.
But what happens if the person is just not forthcoming in any way? Do you just keep on going, or at a certain point do you give up and just throw them in a cell?
Well, this gets to the issue of how does one interrogate, and enhanced interrogation techniques, which the term that came to be used after my involvement. I found quickly that the skills that make a good interrogator are the same as those that make a good operations officer, and they are understanding a person's motivations, fears, hopes, quirks, knowledge, perspective, and establishing a human rapport. Now, it's going to be hideously imbalanced between an interrogator and a detainee, but it is still a human relation.
But what happens? Okay, so you develop this rapport, and now I think, hey, this guy Glenn is a nice guy. I'm not going to immediately tell you everything I know.
No, it's rare, I think, that anyone will say, okay, here are all my cards. I'm revealing everything because, you know, I like you so much. Right. But any conversation reveals something. And intelligence work in general, and I found interrogation too, consists of slowly building a mosaic of an almost infinite number of seemingly inconsequential little pieces of information.
And you weren't the only interrogator originally, but then you were made the lead interrogator?
Well, because I was surged, and this is not a permanent assignment, and we were actually at war and resources are always tight, typically what happens is that an officer will be assigned to do something for a period of months. And then since all of us, in theory, have lives of our own, it's hard to sustain being on the other side of the earth from your family indefinitely and from your normal responsibilities. So you will be replaced every several months, and you will have replaced the person before you.
But so you have to establish this relationship very quickly. What was your relationship with Captus like?
Well, I came to respect the man and actually like him. He didn't tell me the truth all the time. I think anyone in his position would have been terrified and very wary. So I didn't blame him for that at first. It was my job to ease his concerns enough that he would be willing and unconsciously also would say things of use to us, and he did.
But you were never intimidating, I'm assuming?
I wouldn't go
that far. Could you threaten
him? Well, there were, amazingly, no specific guidelines or rules at the time in particular. Early, when I was first being briefed, I was told you will do whatever it takes to get this man to talk. Do you understand? And I immediately understood and was immediately horrified and replied, well, we don't do that. And then
that was suggesting you could hit the guy or waterboarding?
I actually had never heard of waterboarding. I had never heard of the concept until after my time with Captus ended. So that was not a factor. And the guidelines were not rigid at the time. So it was be creative, be aggressive, and make him talk.
Now, if somebody really has nothing to give up, does that sound all that different from somebody who's really clever in answering questions?
Well, that's the question I think the interrogator and the institution have to ask with every answer given.
And what was your feeling about Captus? Was he just being evasive, or did he not know the answers to a lot of the questions you wanted answers to?
Both of those characterizations are accurate for different times of different answers that he gave. And this was one of the ongoing points of discussion between myself as the person doing the interrogating for a couple of months and headquarters. Is he duping me or us? Is he misleading? Is he simply incoherent by nature? Does he know what he's talking about? If so, why is he not? Or if he has, why does headquarters not agree? I mean, those were endless points of discussion.
Were you speaking the same language?
No.
So that has to make developing any kind of intimate relationship more difficult, doesn't it?
Much harder. Much, much harder. I was brought in for, I'd say, a critical characteristic or capability that I had was my linguistic one, although amazingly the agency would not let me write what language it is that I speak. Easily discoverable, but
we all know it's Hungarian.
Yeah, well, no, not quite. But so language was important, and I don't speak Captus, and I do not speak a common language really, mm-hmm. and that does dramatically complicate a human relation.
And it makes for a longer interrogation session, doesn't it? Because everything has to go through translations on both sides.
It makes for exhausting sessions because we would meet all day basically. And it wasn't a direct conversation as you and I are having. So it would be slow and wearing for all concerned.
And what conditions was he living under? Was that a factor here?
It was a factor. I never saw his living conditions in the first country where I went because he was held by a different country's intelligence service. I met him in an interrogation room, the same room every day, in the same conditions always. I know the conditions he was in when he came completely under the control of the CIA, and that was at the second facility.
Which I'm assuming was an improvement?
Oh, I believe it was a dramatic deterioration. The point in sending him to the second facility was to make his life much more miserable, so theoretically he would then become more malleable. It's a point that I argued against from the outset consistently, and much of my effort was to stop that, and I failed.
My guest is Glenn L. Carl, C-A-R-L-E. His book, The Interrogator, An Education, it's published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the first situation, he was under somebody else's control. I'm assuming they were also interrogating him. Were you, or weren't they? Because one of the criticisms of the way some of this was conducted was we would send people to countries where torture was the norm. They'd be mm-hmm. tortured into terrible situations, and then we'd come along and supposedly gain the benefits of what that torture produced.
There were instances like that, a number of them. In the case of Captus, he was held and under the control of a foreign intelligence service. They worked with us and we them on the interrogation, but they did not interrogate him independently most of the time. There were occasions when he was outside of what was happening to him was beyond our knowledge. And we tried to find out what would happen, never could. I was always quite disturbed by what might be occurring, but I never knew.
When you were doing these interrogations, were you hearing of other American interrogators who were physically harming their suspects?
Where I was, no. I did hear learn that someone in our control as a prisoner had died.
Quite a few have, haven't they?
I don't think quite a few, but
well,
several have.
In Afghanistan and...
I don't think quite a few, actually. Detainees, I'm aware of two that come to mind, possibly three. I know of two. Under agency control or involvement, I think two, but I don't know exactly. But I learned of this vague comment, which was astounding. It was inconceivable to me that something like this would happen, where I was, that was not the case at all.
Well, didn't George Tenet, who was the head of the CIA at the time, say that, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques helped get important intelligence and saved American lives?
He did say that, and I'm sure he's sincere. And as I write in my book, I think he and many are a victim of the institution that got it wrong.
Well, the FBI has argued against enhanced interrogation techniques. That was perceived by some as part of the war between the FBI and the CIA.
Yeah, and this one, the FBI has a sterling record, frankly. They have done this as a profession. They took a principled and a practical stand, and they are right.
Well, when did you suspect that Captus might not have had the information that you were asking for?
It was a progressive evolution in my thinking. At first, I accepted. I know my colleagues to be honorable, hardworking, knowledgeable people, and the effort put into the Captus case was very impressive. So I took as Tenet, George Tenet would, of course, the assessment of the experts. I started asking him questions, and he started giving me answers, some of which we could verify and some of which we could disprove. Most of the time, he was telling the truth. And his demeanor, and it was my career, my job was to assess people's motivations by looking him in the eye and talking with him. And I assessed progressively that he was fundamentally truthful.
Because it would be in your best interest to crack this guy and be able to say, well, you know, he really does know all this stuff and here it is.
Oh, of course.
And here's where Osama bin Laden is hiding.
I put myself at odds with the entire institution by progressively challenging the conclusions that had led to his rendition.
So what happened when you told your superiors?
Well, it became Kafkaesque, actually, at any number of levels. Not just with my case, Captus, but specifically, and it's representative of what happened. This will sound unbelievable, but it is true. An officer, I would say, well, he is unable to answer question X. And the response would be, the fact that he's not answering proves that he has the information. Well, I don't think so necessarily. But the instruction would then follow, because he's withholding information, you have to pressure him more. It was a crazy dynamic.
So did they just stop interrogating him after a while?
Well, he was held in detention for 8 years, and my involvement was the first 3 months. I know he was interrogated after my departure. For how long that continued, I don't know.
And was he ultimately freed?
I learned, where are we, July? I learned about in December that he was, yes, with an apology from the U.S. government.
So you were right. Has anybody apologized to you?
Well, hardly. I don't think I have a lot of friends.
But you stayed at the CIA after this, didn't you, for a while?
Oh, yes, for 5 more years until I retired. That's right.
Was your career damaged by what had happened?
By the case, no. No, not at all. Not that I know.
How do you feel about the way the CIA is being run today? Do you think that they've learned from the mistakes of the past?
I think all of my colleagues and the institution as a whole, from the beginning of the agency's involvement in detention and interrogation, was acutely aware of the sensitivity of the task given and vigorously sought clear legal guidance and authorization before doing anything. So everyone was quite concerned from the beginning.
Well, I would assume the last polls I read were a while back. The majority of Americans support or supported harsh interrogation methods to obtain intelligence. And there was the ticking bomb scenario as a central theme on a hit TV show called 24. Then after Osama bin Laden was found and killed, some people argued, mostly former members of the Bush administration, that torture had played a key role in locating bin Laden and that what they had done should be considered something very positive.
Well, you touched upon a number of very important points in your comment just then. One of the main reasons I wrote the book is how disturbed I am by the coarsening of our society and our institutions since 9/11. We have done this to ourselves unnecessarily. And what is this? A poll not long ago, I think it was USA Today, showed that Americans over 35, a majority of Americans over 35, oppose the use of torture. They would consider it simply un-American. A majority of Americans under the age of 35, however, think, well, it's okay. We have to be tough and protect ourselves. The people who you alluded to a moment ago after bin Laden's death, to my knowledge, are all armchair experts in interrogation and defending their policies and know nothing about what works and doesn't. And I can say well before I retired and after my – and independent of my involvement in the Captus case, the agency had concluded that almost without exception, all the information obtained under duress was false.
When John McCain, who knows something about being tortured, said that he didn't think harsh interrogation techniques are useful, one of his colleagues in the Senate said he didn't know what he was talking about.
Well, it's appalling to me that anyone would suggest, one, that Americans should engage in what constitutes torture, two, that it works, and three, would dismiss the assessments of people who actually know firsthand what they are talking about. That's one reason I wrote the book. I'm one of the few who actually has had some experience doing this, and I can tell you that it's appalling to even suggest that enhanced measures provide good intelligence.
Has the war on terror changed since the death of Osama bin Laden?
Well, I've retired and I don't know firsthand.
But you have
much.
Friends, I'm sure, in the agency, and you also.
Yeah, I think
when you read the newspaper, I'm sure you read things that I don't read because you can read
true.
Between the lines.
I think the death of bin Laden has provided an opportunity for policymakers to reassess what our strategic aims and needs are in Afghanistan. And there's a large difference which has been not perceived too often by policymakers and the public between a counterinsurgency and counterterrorism activities. One does not need 100,000 soldiers to conduct counterterrorism operations. One might need that many to conduct a counterinsurgency.
Now, just one other thing before you go. The Times recently published the allegations that the Bush White House in 2005 attempted to discredit Juan Cole, who's a professor at the University of Michigan, a critic of the Iraq War, by obtaining personal information about him. That is something that goes against the CIA's mandate, doesn't it? The CIA is not supposed to even get involved in domestic investigations?
Absolutely not. The Executive Order 12333, which is the founding guiding document of what the agency can and cannot do, makes clear that the agency can have nothing to say at all about American citizens or persons.
But this sort of thing is going on as well. Have the lines blurred in the various responsibilities of the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, and the military intelligence?
Well, the whole NSA wiretapping issue is related to the problem of domestic spying, certainly, but it was a separate instance. I think the common thread is was the White House attempting to use intelligence agencies to conduct unauthorized or illegal activities against American citizens? That's why I reacted as strongly as I did. I was very concerned that that not happen.
Well, it was a shocker during the Nixon administration. Are we shocked anymore?
I was shocked. I didn't think I was so old that only I would recall that. It seemed clear to me.
Glenn L. Carl, his book, The Interrogator, and Education, published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.